Good afternoon. The Health and Human Services Finance Division will come to order. We have we are continuing today with our presentation from the Department of Human Services, and we know the Department of Human Services is a big department. A lot of our budget is under their purview, or theirs is under our purview, I guess I should say. And so we have a lot of ground to cover. So I'd like to get started. I think we're still one short of a quorum, so we can't move the minutes just yet. But I know that Representative Hamilton, you've been studying the minutes.
I have.
So we do have a quorum now. And
I'd like to move the minutes, Madam Chair.
And Representative Hamilton eagerly moves the minutes of February 21st. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing no discussion, is there discussion, Representative Bierman? Okay. Usually we check to make sure our name is on there if we were present. And, you know, anyway, seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. So we will then continue with our budget presentation from the Department of Human Services. And welcome to the committee. We have our deputy commissioners back. And please go ahead and I think you probably have to reintroduce yourselves for the record today, and please go ahead.
Certainly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claire Wilson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services over policy. And just to sort of reground us, we had covered the governor's investments in the child care programs and child welfare. We had been discussing behavioral health and some investments and realignments around those services. And we are now moving on to another population that DHS serves, which is vulnerable adults. So I'll be addressing this first set of packages, or this first package of proposals, that really addresses the need for attention to those in our community. I don't love the terminology vulnerable adults. I feel like just by virtue of our humanity, we're all vulnerable adults. But in this instance, we are referencing, of course, those among us in our communities who rely on care and who can be more suspect to maltreatment. So in 2015, when Minnesota launched the Adult Abuse Reporting Center, we saw a real uptick in those reports and in reports of maltreatment. And it is really incumbent on us as a state, and the governor has made this very clear in his budget, that we really address these incidences of maltreatment and as a system try to do the most we can to allow individuals to live and thrive in the community.
Excuse me one second, Ms. Wilson. I see members flipping through the presentation.
Sure.
So it's after slide 37 in the paper copy. And then we are on, what, page 94?
So I think the next proposal will be on pages 97 of your change pages. So this is the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care.
Great, thank you. 97 in the book. Right, so we're dealing with two different things here. So
right.
Please continue.
Slide 39 on the presentation and page 97 of your change pages. So, you know, when we talk about sort of the, if you want to pick the analogy of the fight against these incidences of maltreatment, when we really think about those on the front lines, we're thinking about the staff from the Ombudsman, from the Office of the Ombudsman of Long-Term Care. These are our staff who are out there in our residential settings and in the community responding to complaints and trying to facilitate resolutions around those complaints. Now, they do an incredible job, and yet their staffing level is far below national averages. So in Minnesota, there's one ombudsman staff for every 9,000 beds. Now, there's 115,000 beds that they are trying to cover. So this proposal makes an investment in their staffing levels, hoping to bring them up more into alignment with the national standards, and that would be an additional 10 staff for the Office of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. And this would add 9 additional ombudsmen to the regional offices and then some central staff. So that is an investment of $1.9 million in fiscal year 2021 and $2 million in the next biennium. Now, the next proposal, which you'll find on pages 100 through 104, really addresses this question of the mark. So, as we've said, we've seen the utilization of the mark has really meant that there's been an increase in the number of reports. So this proposal is addressing 2 different pieces of this work. One is the mark itself and assuring that it's operating with the efficiency and in a sustainable way to maintain this level of reporting. And the other is to really be responsive to the fact that there's been this increase in reports and that a majority of those reports are referred to the counties.
And Ms. Wilson, the mark is the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center.
That is correct, yes. I'm sorry. I think I might have said that initially, but
okay.
Yes, the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, or the MARC, and that is the common point of entry for maltreatment reports. So when a report comes into the MARC, it's triaged to one of the lead investigative agencies, so rather MDH or DHS or the counties. And then if there's any component that would require it to be referenced to law enforcement, it also goes to law enforcement. Now, a large majority of, or over half of all of those reports that are triaged to investigative agencies are also going to law enforcement. There need to be some system improvements in this area because it's frequently not referred to the appropriate jurisdiction because we lack some GIS mapping capabilities. And also it's coming to law enforcement in a way that they can't automatically input into their system. So they're, you know, typing in the PDF, which is making law enforcement cranky. So this will be some improvements to that process. And then it also requires 24/7 support, IT support, which it doesn't currently have, which is necessary for the ongoing, you know, addressing any concerns that happen. And then there is also some investment here in creating a real-time dashboard so that we can really be tracking the reports. Now, the majority of the investment, however, in this proposal is really going to the counties and to the tribes to increase and fortify their adult protective services. So those are grants to counties and tribes that will be increased. So in total, this proposal invests $4 million in fiscal year 2021 and just under $5.5 million in the next biennium.
I believe we have a question on this. Pete, would this be a good time to take a question, Ms. Wilson, on this?
Madam Chair, certainly.
Okay. Representative Loft.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Wilson. I see that most of the proposal is dealing with systems and flow of information. I have concerns about whether or not we're actually got the right people at the right place doing this. I have heard from a number of complaints at over time, complaints that the call takers are people sometimes without even high school educations. It used to be that most counties had social workers who could ask kind of the right follow-up questions so that the information, when it gets been passed on to the county 24 to 48 hours or longer, is incomplete and confusing. And I would hope that before we invest too much money into systems that you really have some real discussions about the end users who are the clients ultimately that the report is on, but then the intermediaries who need to actually do the real investigation and response. Do we flag within 2 hours the ones that it feels like someone's health is seriously in jeopardy? You know, I mean, if you're going to deal with the 24 to 48 hour lag, you need to also deal with the lag of ones that can't wait 2 hours before somebody should be alerted. And so I'm just asking you to talk to all the people involved before you invest in a lot of systems upgrade to make sure that it meets their needs as well as yours.
Ms. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that. And there are multiple points of entry, right? So there's the report that's made, There's the automation in terms of how that's referred to different agencies to respond. And then there's our federal and state requirements around that response time, depending on the nature of the complaint. And these are moderate investments in the system that improve some of those more automated processes and allow us more access to real-time information. But you are right that ongoing engagement around this system, because it is relatively new to have this central reporting point of entry, that we do need to continue to hear how it's working across the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Please continue. We do have another question. Representative Noor, was it to this part?
Yes, okay, the same question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, welcome. My question is the integration of MAC and SSIS, which Department of Health talked about. How will this be included in that process?
Ms. Wilson.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, some of that integration will help with the small investment here in the real-time dashboard. So one of our concerns is that we continue to be able to track reports as effectively as possible. So that flow of information will be helped there. But this is slightly separate than that integration with SSIS.
Representative Noor?
Thank you for the clarification. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So the next proposal is on pages 105 through 107. Oh, thanks. And this proposal really gets to the fact that so many individuals now are residing in assisted living settings, and yet there's not great information out there either for families or consumers around the quality of those services. And certainly since the department is sometimes paying for those services as well, it's really incumbent for us to have a mechanism by which we are able to measure quality. So there are approximately 69,000 beds at registered housing and services settings in Minnesota, and that's at over 1,700 sites. So this proposal has come about through lots of stakeholder engagement around our work around elder abuse with MDH and with many of our stakeholders. And this proposes the creation of an assisted living report card, sort of similar to the nursing facility report card, that would be dependent on surveys of both consumers and families and would allow us to have some quality measures to really report on how people are experiencing and the quality of the services in assisted livings. So this invests $1.7 million in fiscal year 2021, and then $1.5 million in 2022-23, and the report card would be fully implemented by August of 2022.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. Going to page 108 in your budget book or slide 42, there's a couple of proposals here that are in the vulnerable adult section that are OIG licensing proposals that we think are really important to support our efforts to protect vulnerable adults. On slide 42 is the licensing for home and community-based services. This proposal invests additional staffing for the licensing to address increase the number of maltreatment reports that we're getting through HCBS provider door, as well as to increase the frequency of our inspections. We're currently doing inspections on home and community-based services once every 4.8 years, or almost once every 5 years. This would reduce that to 3 years. We think that that's really critically important. These are often very isolated settings with very vulnerable people, and not getting out there more frequently than every 5 years, I think, creates a lot of risk for the individuals that we're serving. There are about 32,000 vulnerable persons who live in these licensed settings, and this would bring our into compliance with the federal government waiver that we have around HCBS. The history behind this is that in 2012-13, the legislature created standards for licensing of HCBS providers, and then we were given 3 years to develop a set a fee schedule in place to pay for the licensing and oversight of these facilities. We brought proposals in 2016 and 2017 that were not adopted by the legislature, and we're bringing it back again this year. This is a fee-based proposal. It would increase fees on the providers in order to pay for the additional 10 staff that would deal with the maltreatment investigations and with the licensing inspections. There are about 3,600 of these residential settings around the state, so it's a lot of settings and a lot of activity for our staff.
We do have a question on that, Mr. Johnson. Representative Munson?
Madam Chair, thank you, and I apologize. I have a question about the previous topic. My gears were turning. Can I just ask a follow-up question on the MARC system?
Well, Mr. Johnson, is this a good place for you to pause?
Madam Chair, that's fine.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Representative Munson.
My question's on the MARC system, and I just have deep concerns about integrating health data and public safety in criminal justice data. And can you explain to me the system that is operated under DHS, that the law enforcement officers will be able to create reports on reporting vulnerable adults? Will the data only come one direction from law enforcement, or will they have access to any health records or health data that's entered into that system? Because I have just deep concerns on that.
Ms. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question. So, no, this proposal is just addressing the report that comes into the MARC being relayed to law enforcement so that they can respond. There is no additional data sharing between law enforcement or of any additional data to law enforcement. It's the report that goes to them, and then they follow up on that report.
And Representative Munson.
So people that work for the Department of Health would enter a complaint that the police would have access to see, or just it's completely the other way around?
Ms. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative, so in the system that we're talking about right now, so a complaint would come into the MARC, right? Let's just envision MARC however you'd like. And the report has a couple of components, right? So it may get the complaint, depending on its nature, where it came from, what occurred, it would get triaged to the appropriate agency to investigate that complaint. So it might go to MDH. Now there might be, or it might go to DHS, or it might go to one of the counties, depending on the nature of the complaint. But the complaint might also have a component that would require law enforcement to be notified. So then that complaint would also be transferred to law enforcement. And the mechanism now by which that report is transferred, it doesn't go to law enforcement in a way that allows them to really incorporate it into their systems quickly, and it also doesn't always go to the right jurisdiction. So this particular proposal only addresses those two issues.
Okay.
And Representative Munson.
Can you confirm that no patient health data would be included in that record that police officers would be accessing if they were to receive a complaint?
Ms. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I mean, I'd be remiss to say, like, I absolutely cannot, can say that no health data may have been transferred. That would certainly not be in any way typical necessarily of a complaint, but we could follow up with you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. Thanks for the questions. I do think these are the kind of questions other members will have as well, so that would be helpful. So, Mr. Johnson, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on page 105 of the budget book, the assisted living report card. Where are the $80,000 in savings? Where is the savings coming from for a report card implementation in 2023?
Ms. Wilson, this was...
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I'm not entirely sure. I may have to follow up with you on that. That may just be some shifting from some of the current grants into this work is what I believe is reflective of. Assistant Commissioner Dan Pollack will respond to your question.
Madam Chair,
yeah,
Dan Pollack, Assistant Commissioner for DHS, and Representative Schultz, if you look on page 107, there's an existing grant program that is being phased out. The funding is being repurposed for the AL report card. Mm-hmm. So that savings item continues basically for the entire forecast period, but it's using the funding to build the infrastructure for a more effective program.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Johnson, back to you.
Madam Chair, I'm just finishing up on the HCBS licensing. There are about 1,600 providers who are licensed under this statute. The licensing fee schedule that we're suggesting, for those that bill public programs $5 million or less, There would be about a 20% increase in their fee in order to cover the additional 10 FTEs. For providers that bill above $5 million to public programs, that would be more than 20%, and it varies some depending on the size of the provider, up to and including a very small number of providers that would have what look like very large fee increases, more than doubling, but in no case are those fees represent anything more than one-fifth of 1% of the revenues that those organizations earn through public program financing for ACBS. So this is a net neutral to the general fund because it is a fee-based proposal. Page 112 in the budget book and slide 43. This is similarly a licensing proposal. This one is related to adult day center oversight improvements. This is an area we've been seeing quite a bit of growth over the last several years in adult day programs. They mostly serve seniors but also serve some people with disabilities. There's also been an increased number of concerns about noncompliance within these programs against licensing standards. We received an audit from the U.S. Office of Inspector General citing a number of concerns in all 20 of the centers that they looked at. And we think it's really important that we step up our oversight of these facilities going forward. Again, it's a very vulnerable population. This would essentially be a $269,000 in 2021 and $270,000 in 2022-23 to add two FTEs to our oversight function for these adult day centers.
Mr. Johnson, we have a question. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Deputy Commissioner Johnson. I note in the description on page 112 that you've seen a 27% increase in these facilities in just the last 2 years, and they're increasingly changing to serve disability population, not just frail seniors. And if we can get some more background on it, it could be another one of those things where we're drifting into a change service model without a conscious policy direction, and it's particularly concerning when 20 out of 20 are out of compliance, and some of them could not find any demonstration that they're providing any services at all. To me, that's a fraud investigation. But we really need to get a handle on the growth on this. If it's starting to serve a different population, why are people being put in adult day centers rather than in the more traditional settings? What sort of population? Are they mixing the right groups? I'm not saying that it's inappropriate to have younger people with disabilities with seniors with early dementia, but that may not be the best case for everyone. And so if we could get some more background on this, that would be helpful. It just feels like there's a lot of warning signs, and I'm glad you're stepping up with some additional resources.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, I'd be happy to provide you with more information and dig into this a little bit. I agree completely. I mean, that was our reaction when we saw the audit, is like, what's going on in some of these? And to your point, there were seven or eight of them that the auditor called out to us as to whether they were even providing services under adult day. And we did send in the OIG investigators and have worked with all of those. Several of them shut themselves down. Several of them were taking action against. So there is a lot of fast growth happening here that I think we need to get our arms around and get a little bit ahead of it, so we're not always trying to catch up to what's happening with some of these services.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so the next section of the budget that we'll talk about is long-term services and supports. And, you know, when we really look at the system, there's two challenges that we just need as a state to address, in which this budget is attempting to do. One is the workforce. And I just feel like I am, you know, kind of on repeat on this constantly. But if we do not find a way to address our workforce challenges, we are not going to be able to care for people in the community or, frankly, in other settings. The other piece, of course, is really looking at the growth in these programs. And it is a large investment on the part of the state to assure that people are accessing the right services in the right settings in a way that meets their needs. And we just see continued growth in this area. So these proposals are really trying to be responsive to that growth in a way that assures access, that assures people still have the services and the quality of service that meets their need, but that we as a state are somehow responding to the increased demand for these services. So the first proposal that directly addresses this is the Simplify and Streamline Home and Community-Based Waiver System. So this is pages 114 through 119. This is really a look at our four disability waivers, which service over 47,000 Minnesotans. So currently, the waiver system is very complex. And it is difficult, I mean, it is difficult for myself as a bureaucrat to explain. It's really, really difficult for families to navigate and for people to understand the services that are available to them. The legislature very wisely mandated the department to really go look at and study how these waivers are designed and how they are accessed. And then at the same time, to look at the ways in which the budgets are developed. So to really look at individualized budgeting so that we are making sure that budgets are fitting people's actual needs and that we're not just having, you know, these cost allocations to the counties that are then going out in the forms of budgets through the waivers. So this launched what we proudly call the Waiver Reimagine Project. And this proposal is the first phase of that Reimagine Project. So this came with extensive stakeholder engagement. And I just really can't thank enough all of the community members who engaged in this, because this is very complex work and required a lot of thinking on a lot of different people's parts. But what this proposal in front of us is doing right now is just preparing us as a state to move towards a more streamlined and simplified waiver system. So this would lead us to two waivers, one for one people would access if they need services in the community, and one that people would access if they need services in a residential setting. And it would also move us more towards an individualized budgeting methodology for those services. So what's really in front of you right now is just a proposal to start to streamline services within the existing waivers, and that's where you see some of those savings, because we are addressing some of either duplication in services or just where there's unnecessary service lines and some changes to some of those service lines. So we're preparing us to have some more uniformity across those services. And then it's also directing the department to look at value-based purchasing, value-based and outcome payment for some of these services, so that we can come more into alignment with some of the ways in which healthcare is paid for, and so that we can be really incenting quality and value outcomes in these services. And then there are some investments in here just for families and for education, and so that people now can start to better understand the waivers and the options available to people, and then really assure that, as you know, as we start to move the system, that we're bringing families and along with us and others who are advocating. So this is an investment of $2.9 million in 2021, and then actually a savings of $5 million in 2022-23. And this will really, again, launch us into what will hopefully be a more streamlined and accessible waiver system, which also, with that individualized budgeting, allows us to really start to control for some of this growth in a way that doesn't limit access, but actually encourages the right service at the right time for people. Oh, come on, that was a fun one for questions. Okay, so speaking of complicated, let's just move on to DWRS. So,
Ms. Wilson?
Yes. Oh, too soon.
Too soon. Representative Van Hagen.
Well, she wanted a question.
I set myself up for this.
Thank you for your presentation, Deputy Commissioners. So where does the savings come from on this? You show $3,048,000 in 2022, and then another $1,941,000. Just when you say streamline, what is being eliminated? Is it some of the bureaucracy? Is it paying for the services that are actually needed versus what we're doing now? I'm on page 114
in the book. Yeah, Ms. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes, we're eliminating all bureaucracy in this program.
Madam Chair, I think you're up for that.
These waivers are just going to administer themselves. No. What we're doing is bringing... What we're doing is bringing some of the services into alignment. So that is where there is some savings. Some is around removing, we did some cost study or some studies around a couple of the different factors, and it's bringing those, particularly some of the absence factors and day training and habilitation, and bringing that more into alignment with actual absent factors. So some of it is an elimination of some duplicative lines of services. Some is as aligning the billing appropriately with the actual cost of the services.
Representative Bernhagen. Okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you speak about an individualized budget model, are you going to be moving away from the framework model for paying for these services, and the money's going to be attached to a person in need, or how's that going to work?
Ms. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, so we're not entirely sure exactly how it will work yet. That's part of this proposal, is kind of, you know, coming into that methodology. It would not be entirely removed from the framework, but it would be similar to how the consumer-directed community supports the CDCS budgeting works now. So it would be a budget that still the cost would be set on the framework, but would be individualized towards the assessed needs of the individual.
Very good.
Representative Schultz.
I like it. Thank you.
Okay, we got Grunhagen and Schultz, and now Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This one will actually encounter a lot of discussion, but I assume that that would be when you bring forward the legislation. We really understand what the consolidation and streamlining of these services are, because one would hope, as we have tried to go to more person-centered planning, that it actually becomes more individualized. And when you say you've consolidated seven services into three, it tends to kind of maybe process people into bigger buckets rather than into individualized services. It tends to make providers fight for what bucket they can get someone assigned to, as opposed to doing an individualized plan for that individual. My hope with individual budgets is that actually the consumer and or the person who helps them make decisions actually picks and chooses from a menu. And they say, I don't want these kind of services from my day training program. I want to instead buy these things. And instead of saying they have to pick, well, you get A, B, or C. If we're really going to a more person-centered process when we get to the hearing on this, I hope you'll really tell us how that works, because the narrative seems to actually reduce the options to a lesser number of choices and a lesser number of reimbursement categories.
All right. Well, Ms. Wilson, I don't know if you want to answer, but just maybe we'll just keep going, because I do want to get through the presentation today, and I know that I hope we can finish. And this, believe me, members, this will not be the last time we hear about any of these issues, because we don't have the bills yet, and so we will discuss this again. I do appreciate a lot of the questions, though. They're very good. But please continue.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. So this next proposal really addresses this unprecedented challenge in the workforce, and in particular for services provided under the disability waiver rate setting system. So this proposal provides a competitive workforce factor into the disability waiver rate setting system. This will be about a 4% increase in the rate setting system that would be directed to wages and benefits for the workforce that would bring them more up to the competitive level of other similarly situated labor folks in the labor field. This will also increase the inflationary adjustments from 5 to 2 years to better keep up with current inflation. And then, you know, the hope is really that this will enable our providers to attract and retain a workforce. And part of this proposal is a mandated study that we will do with providers to assure that it is having an impact on the health of the workforce. So, again, this is really structuring an increase into the disability waiver rate setting system that directly addresses the need to attract and retain a workforce within these services.
All
The next proposal that I know got a lot of discussion yesterday in Representative Schultz's committee, so we'll just kind of speak briefly to it, but I know that it will be another one for which there will be more discussion as session moves forward. But this is really addressing our nursing facility value-based reimbursement program. And, you know, since its passage, we have really, in 2015, the new system, VBR, the value-based reimbursement system, has really been studied and looked at to think about, are we actually incenting the quality that we need from these facilities while at the same time assuring that they are being paid for their cost? And there are some adjustments that are going to be necessary to VBR in order to assure that we're incenting the quality that that was designed to incent. So this makes some changes to the value-based reimbursement system to better bring in an alignment to really incent that. And then there's also property rate reform within this proposal to bring that system also into alignment. So this is a fairly significant savings proposal. This saves $11.8 million in 2021 and $56.4 million in 2022-23. And then finally, the last proposal that is again addressing the workforce, and this for a different segment of the workforce, is our obligation to fulfill the contract with the Service Employees Union International, or SEIU. And this was the contract that was negotiated for 2021. So this includes an increase to the minimum wage rule for individual providers to $13.25 an hour. It increases the paid time off accrual rate to 1 hour for every 40 hours. And it also establishes holiday time at time and a half. So again, this is a segment of the workforce that is significantly underpaid. And this is an investment, you know, to keep us in, again, within our contractual obligation to SEIU with the state.
And Ms. Wilson, if I could just ask you, this is a question that I had to have answered myself, but I think it would be helpful for members to understand who is in this group, because obviously it's not everybody that is doing direct service work with people with disabilities. So could you just kind of explain who this pertains to?
So this particular proposal pertains to the approximately, well, just under 44,000 personal care attendants who are participating in self-directed PCA work or in the consumer-directed supports work. So it's a particular segment of our direct support workforce. And that's a good question because the DWRS proposal, of course, is addressing workers who are working under waivered services. So we have different direct care workforce individuals who we often kind of conflate into one direct care workforce. But this is for the PCAs who are doing self-directed PCA.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we're going to shift now and talk about direct care and treatment. Direct care and treatment is the part of the agency that directly delivers services to individuals across Minnesota. Generally, the people that we serve in our direct care and treatment are people who are committed to us civilly through the courts, or people and or people who private providers can't or won't serve due to the complexity of their needs. We have about 200 sites across the state. We have 4,500 employees who work in this part of our agency, and we have big campuses in Anoka and St. Peter, Moose Lake, and other places around the state. The first proposal that's on page 138 of your budget book relates to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. This is a request for additional $9 million a year, or $18 million for each biennium, essentially to maintain 85 FTEs of staff that we currently have within that program, as well as adding 10 new FTEs. This is really a request that comes out of a lot of the work that we've been doing over the last 6 or 7 years to be responsive to the pressure that has come to us through various court challenges. That includes the creation of the Community Preparation Services, which is a service that sits on the St. Peter campus, It is outside of the razor wire, so it is not within the secure environment. It is for men who are toward the end stages of their treatment, potentially getting ready for the community. Courts order individuals to that part of the service. We right now have a census of 89 in that service. That's the maximum that we can handle within that service. We also have 35 individuals waiting to get into CPS who have been given a court order to be ordered there, and we don't have room for them right now. In addition, we are increasingly dealing with reintegration of individuals into the community. By statute, when someone is provisionally discharged from the sex offender program, we, DHS and the sex offender program, are responsible for the integration of those individuals into the community and oversight of those individuals in the community. So we've created essentially a reintegration team that works with those individuals in the community, helps work on placements, provides daily oversight of what's going on with the individuals, as well as at least one house that we're now running ourselves of individuals who are in the community. Each of these have been done essentially within our budget for the sex offender program. We've come back a couple of times to ask for additional funding for these additional services and not been successful. We're in a position now where we're funding these services essentially based on money that we borrowed from FY18 and carried forward from other services within direct care and treatment. And so it's really important that we get these services funded this year, both to maintain those services, which are really critical to maintain legal compliance of the sex offender program, but also because staffing those services really does impact what happens within the razor wire, too, and our ability to staff adequately within the area, where we have had several meetings with our own employees who are concerned about the safety within the environment of the program. And obviously, we did have a very traumatic event that happened a couple of weeks ago up at Moose Lake with an individual client who's been charged with attempted murder of one of our staff. So we believe that for legal risk purposes, as well as for the safety of our staff and the other clients we serve, as well as the safety of communities when we are reintegrating these individuals back in on provisional discharge, the courts have really been continuing to escalate the number of people that they're ordering out on provisional discharge. We have 21 that are out right now, and we have about 4 more that are waiting we're finding placements for. So the request is pretty simple. It is straightforward for about $9 million a year to fund the staffing within the sex offender program.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 50 of the slides, it talks about providing MSOP with the ability to charge counties 25% for the cost of care for clients that are provisionally discharged. I know we do a cost share currently. If you have an offender from your charged out of your county, from your county, that is civilly committed, there's a cost share during their commitment. Does this basically just extend that cost share when they're provisionally discharged?
Madam Chair and Representative Zerwas, thank you for pointing that out. I forgot to mention that. Yes, it does. That is exactly what it does. That share under current law doesn't continue when they're provisionally discharged. It will help us to continue to fund those services, and since the counties are paying for the person when they were within our care, we think it's appropriate to pay when they're provisionally discharged as well.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just follow up to help clarify for me. The county being charged is, my understanding, it's the originating county. It's not always possible to place someone back in community from the originating county. Does the new home county pick up the 25% charge, or is that still from the originating county? I don't know if my question makes sense to you.
It does.
Madam Chair and Representative Zerwas, it's the committing county, the county that committed the individual to the program.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, and that was my issue of concern, too. On page 139, it notes that there's already 70 communities that have tried to pass zoning ordinances. I think they're being challenged in the court to say none of these people can reside in our community, even though they may have come from their community. And if we're going to cost shift an extra couple million dollars onto property taxes, I think we ought to look at that issue, because we cannot concentrate all of these people back into one or two or three or four counties where you might be able to talk a landlord into taking someone. And so I would actually suggest that you look at maybe that if they're relocated in the committed county, they don't have to pay. But if they're relocated into someone else's county, I'm up with even higher than 25%. Because I think everybody has in their community people who have problems. And we need to have the whole state step up to help us with reintegrating people who have the legal right to return to their community. And so I would really encourage you to look at the legal issues that might be involved if we were to create some incentives for counties throughout the state to step up, because we cannot continue to concentrate these issues in one or two or three places.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. I'm not sure about the financing aspect of it, but I certainly agree with you on the housing ordinances that have gotten in the way of many of these placements, and it's become very difficult. And corrections experience is the same. Place individuals back into the community, and that's become a barrier that makes it harder for us, which is why we have some folks that are still in the program, because we can't find a placement for them in the community, and sometimes it takes a very long time to find those. And there are a few communities that are good about working with us. There's some private providers we work with that are really good at taking these individuals and providing the proper oversight, but it's a challenge not to have them all end up in the same two or three places.
Okay, I think you can continue, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, the next slide addresses the Minnesota State Operated Community Services, or MSOCs. That's on page 141 of your budget book. MSOCs is a service that exists within direct care and treatment that it's kind of two pieces. One is residential. You have about 450 people live in 120 group homes across the state that we run. And then there's vocational services for 670 people who we serve through vocational services. MSOC's history is kind of came out of the deinstitutionalization from the big facilities we used to run. And these smaller facilities were created and run by state employees as part of how we deinstitutionalized. Over time, we've scaled this service back to some degree. We are now really aggressively trying to move toward shifting these services to serving those individuals who have really complex conditions, particularly behavioral kinds of conditions, that often can't or won't be served by other providers in the community. The community providers may struggle to serve them because of the complexity of their needs. We think that's a real special spot where MSOCs can step in and provide those services. And, of course, as an integrated health system, we see the need, because these are the individuals coming out of Anoka and St. Peter that we have difficulty often placing in the community because there aren't private providers that will take them. What we're doing now is working with counties through the transition of this process to identify homes that we can transition over to being for more complex individuals, potentially transition to other providers if it's a home that the county wants to keep, but we don't need to be involved because it's a more standard population that can be served by any provider. And that process is ongoing. But as we go through that, we are continuing to need to support this program until we get to where we can have rates through the DWRS system that support all of the individuals that we're serving adequately. What this proposal does is essentially provides MSOCs with the money for an operating adjustment for the next several years based on our current expected costs for salaries and non-salary costs for the our staff. And that is mostly actually in the non-salary area related to some agreements that were made a couple of years ago around health care and pension that were not funded in enterprise services. MSOCs lives off of revenues, and so when these kind of adjustments happen, those dollars don't always follow through to the people on the enterprise side of our services who are dependent on rates that are paid within other parts of the system. So this would provide us with those dollars, about $5.3 million in the 2021 biennium, and $7.5 million in the 2022-23 biennium, which maintains about 46 FTEs that we need to continue with the transition of these services.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Johnson. I know that on page 142, one of your goals is to work with counties to fill vacancies within the state-operated residential homes, and I can just say I think that part of our person-centered commitment and our commitments under the Olmstead Plan are to serve people close to family and community and keep those relationships. And I will just say that it is very difficult for families in the metro area to be asked to have their loved ones go off to rural areas for which there is no public transportation, where they have a difficult time, you know, maintaining any connection, may be people of color and not served by any employees of color, and feel very unsupported. And I hope that as you're rebalancing your system, you will look at where is the population in need and develop the services in those communities, rather than asking people to send, you know, just as rural people may not feel comfortable sending their family members to an inner city North Minneapolis facility, it's a big shift to ask someone within Minneapolis to send their loved one to a place far away that is very difficult for them to get to.
Okay. Madam Chair and Mr. Representative Loeffler, I appreciate that question and agree completely. So that's why we're working so closely with counties in doing this transition, to identify what needs are that they have in their community and figure out how we can help them to meet those needs. It's never our intent to move people around, but when I go back and talk again about the previous question about it is difficult at times to find a site and a setting for an individual with very complex needs that we can get a landlord who will lease it to us in order to have us provide particular kinds of services there, particularly for people who have some tendency to have behavioral challenges. And a lot of folks may or may not want to have in their communities. So it's not necessarily always the sex offender label. It can be other behavioral challenges that make it difficult for some communities to be as open or accepting. And that can become an issue sometimes in where someone ends up getting placed. But placement close to family should be a high priority. It always is in how way we try to do our work.
Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, how does the salary or wages of employees in the SOX program compare to those of similar entities outside of the SOC program?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, they're generally higher because they are state employees, and that's partly why we believe that we need to be working toward a specialized service that higher salaried employee can particularly provide that may not be as easy for a private provider to do. So that's partly why we see the space, the appropriate space for the state employee staff group homes to be probably a somewhat smaller and more specialized than just the broad we're caring for anybody the same as any private provider would.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Thank you. Okay. All right. I think we can continue.
Madam Chair, slide 52 and pages 144, 145 in your budget book. This is a very simple proposal, but it has some extremely complex financing behind it that we're planning on simplifying. This it relates to four programs that we run that we call Minnesota Specialty Health Services. They are essentially ERTS, intensive residential treatment services. That's how they're licensed. That's a step-down program for people with mental illness who may have had hospitalization, aren't quite ready to go to the community, need some inpatient residential care until they're ready to move to the community. We operate four of these, one in Wilmer, one in Wadena, one in St. Paul, and one in Brainerd. And right now they're licensed for 16 beds, but based on our appropriation, we can only afford to manage about 12 beds in each. So we have capacity of about 16 beds across the four of them that we're not meeting. What this proposal would do is allow us to add 34 FTEs to bring all four of those up to 16 beds and create 16 more beds across the system. This is a really needed level of care within our system right now, and we have an opportunity to do that within our state system by adding these beds and these FTEs. So that part of it is fairly straightforward. What's complicated is the way these things are funded now. What we're proposing to move to is funding all of them directly with a general fund appropriation and having all the receipts that they earn, because they do earn money from reimbursement from medical assistance or Medicare or private payment, go back to the general fund. And that actually results in quite a savings to the state budget for this reason. In 2010, there was a particular account created into which some of the receipts from these centers have been going into, and it builds up balances in this account. There's actually no way to get money back out of that account unless the legislature takes action to take money back out, which we've done, you've done, we've done periodically when we needed money for something with indirect current treatment or for the bottom line or wherever. We've drawn some of that money out. What this would do is say, let's just get rid of that account,
take the money that's in there now, drop it to the bottom line. That creates savings for the general fund. And then going forward, have general fund appropriation to these four ERTS facilities to support them at a full 16 beds, and the receipts go back to the general fund. It nets out to be a one-time savings in 2020, and then a small ongoing savings across the remainder of the forecast horizon.
Oh, Representative Kunesh Padin, I can't see you. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, two questions. Are these just for adults? Is there a separate program for adolescents or younger? That's the first question. And this is only 64 beds if you have 16 times 4 and there's 4 facilities. Is there a suggestion to increase beds or opportunities for folks as mental illness seems to be escalating? Is there any thought to doing some pre-planning for accommodating the rise in mental illness? Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative, these are for adults. We run a hospital for children with psychiatric needs in Willmar. Called the Child Adolescent Behavioral Health Services. There are also, Ms. Wilson talked, I believe, last week probably about the psychiatric residential treatment facilities, which is a new level of care we're creating across the state for children. So that's where the children's side kind of sits. We're not planning at DHS to create more state-operated of these facilities, but there is a need for them across the state. I know Elk River just approved creation of one last week, or recently approved creation of one within Elk River. And so we are trying to encourage creation of more of them in the private side. They don't need to be run by DHS in order to be successful. Ours are a little bit more specialized to certain populations in a couple of cases, so that's helpful. Yes, it's a much-needed level of care.
Thank you. Okay. I think we can continue.
Madam Chair, the last slide for DCT on page 53 of the slides, page 146 of your budget book. This would repeal a rider from 2010 language. This is a rider that required the department to do a 9 or 10 different things. They're detailed in the budget page, all of which we have addressed. So each of those have been done. The rider included language that said that it would never sunset, essentially, that it would never expire. So we would like to expire the rider because we've accomplished everything. The one thing that allows us to do as well is the rider has some very restrictive language around what we can do with our dental clinics. We operate 5 dental clinics around the state. These are specialized to populations, developmentally disabled individuals, others with behavioral challenges who can't go to a regular dentist. We provide dental services to that population. It said we had to provide the same level of staffing, the same level of service, the same locations that were in effect in March. We don't feel like that's actually allowing us to grow and be flexible in where we're providing and how we're providing those services. For example, we'd like to hire more dental therapists. Technically, under this rider, we can't change our staffing. We'd like to hire behavioral health people to work with the populations in the dental clinics. Technically, again, that's something we can't do. So this would allow us the flexibility to manage those dental clinics to where we need to in order to ensure that we have the coverage for the specialized dental across the state. Shifting gears to system modernization, this is one proposal that relates to our ongoing work to modernize what we're doing both in the IT area, but I really want to emphasize the work and how this impacts what we're doing in terms of modernizing and transforming the way we deliver human services. We talk about system modernization, and that's a topic that many of you are familiar with. We have aging IT systems. They don't work very well. They don't serve the populations very well. They don't work for our county partners or our tribal partners. They don't work for the people we serve very well. And there's risk with having old systems and old languages that people don't know how to use. But the more important piece, and I think this is a lesson that, you know, we're all learning as we try to do large IT projects, is we need to make sure that we know where we want to be and how we're delivering services and what our business model is going to look like in the future in order to be successful in actually then bringing the IT along behind that. And so what this proposal does, it supports efforts for foundational transformation of the human services delivery system. And this would provide a more integrated and person-centered design for human services. This is work that we've been doing. And so what this proposal allows us to do with $10 million a year for 2 years only is to continue to do that work. The focus here is really on what we do with how we're changing our business. And this is focused on a model called Integrated Services Business Model that we've developed working with the counties and the tribes to really move us toward a more person-centered way of delivering services, a way that breaks down the silos that exist within our service system so we can serve families as families, we can serve multi-generational and two-generational approaches, and not be stuck working within the silos that we deliver through now. It's really focused on meeting the needs of individuals and trying to get upstream on services so that we can address problems before they become bigger problems. And it's also focused on improving the equity and the outcomes within our system, as Commissioner Lori talked about last week, with the terrible disparities we have in Minnesota, and trying to create a model of service delivery that's going to help us address those issues as well. A big piece of this is simplifying our programs and streamlining our programs as well. And that's a piece that we've been doing some work on, we'll continue to work on, because trying to move forward with the complexity that we have in our system right now is going to subject us to failure, particularly on the IT side, but really on the service delivery side too. And we don't talk a lot here about how we deliver services. We talk about the particular silos and the changes we're making within them, what the laws look like, how much money is in it. We don't talk about how those things interact at the level of the individual who has trying to get their needs met across those multiple silos. So what the proposal would really do is three things. One, it would help us fund this continuing to work on this business change, working with the counties, working with the tribes, working with the providers and other stakeholders in the system to really prepare ourselves for what where we want to go with business in the future, how we do the business readiness work to be ready to change the way we deliver services, and how we do that collectively across agreement across all parties. It would allow us to continue to do some of the necessary IT work that we need to do related to compliance, related to challenges the counties are having. That includes the MET system, which does healthcare eligibility, which we continue to work on improving over the last several years. And then finally, it really funds us to do some careful planning to figure out how we go about doing this. If this is our business vision, what are the right next steps? How do we bring IT into that? What kind of IT do we want to be looking at, and what's the best path forward for us? And I feel like we need to get to that question and come back to you and say, this is what the plan looks like, because that's when it's going to be a real costly approach going forward as we start to look more at building the actual IT. So this is really just sustaining some of what we have going on now to put a good plan in place so we can figure out the appropriate next steps and be ready for delivering the IT that we need for the future. It's one-time money, and that's on purpose. You shouldn't be giving us more money until we can come back to you and tell us exactly where we're going and how much money we're going to need to get there.
And Representative Hamilton has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate hearing about the IT and the proposal. It's long overdue, and I just wanted to share with you here a couple weeks ago we had someone from the county, I believe, they did a handout of all the paperwork they need to go through for individuals that are signing up for services, and this would be a great place to start when we're talking about efficiency. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Hamilton, thank you for that. I was thinking about that very thing, yeah. And I bet a lot of us were, and I bet that's a piece of this. Representative Baker also has a question.
And Madam Chair, thank you. I think it's to Representative Hamilton's comments. My question would be simply, if we ask the counties what they thought of the METS program today, do they want you to continue to dive into that deeper and fix it or try something different? Because I want to know, because those counties have shared that same information, and it's not efficient at all, and we need to find a better help. So what I know you were going to come back, but how can we say it's the right thing to do now?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, I don't know that I can speak for where the counties are at, where individual counties are, where they are at collectively exactly. I know a couple years ago They did come here and ask for more money for the MET system. At that time, their conclusion was that continuing to invest in the system was the right path forward. I don't know if they are still there or not. My conversations with counties, I would say that most counties are interested in continuing to invest in the system. That doesn't necessarily mean that everybody sees it as the right long-term path. I think that's probably a second question that we need to do some digging on now, but not stopping improving the system while we're doing that, because it's going to take some time to replace it, even if we decide to go a different direction.
Representative Neuer, and then Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Johnson, good to see you again. I worked under you since 2004. I've known you very well, and you've been doing a great job, so thank you. My question is, we moved to the Curum system a while back. This was to streamline the whole process from healthcare to public assistance program and many programs that we do have the silos. Are we walking away from that system to a new system, or are we trying to improve so that that system works for every group that we're going to be serving?
Madam Chair, Representative Neuer, I'm not ready to say we're walking away from it today or that we're committed to it. I think that's part of what we need to be evaluating. So the Curum system is what the MET's system sits on. It's the Curum software. Obviously we've struggled with it, and I don't know that that's necessarily an indictment of Curum writ large. We did some review of these systems back, in 2011, I think, of all the various vendors that were out there. And certainly at that time, Curum looked like the best product for getting where we want to go. I think we need to redo that and make that assessment again. We've been talking to a number of other states that have done various modernization of their IT systems. Different vendors, different approaches to it, different, leveraging legacy. They've all done it in somewhat different ways. So there's different pathways to get there. And so I'm not saying that we're walking away from Curum, but I'm not going to say necessarily that we know that's the right path at this point either.
Representative Neuer?
One just quick follow-up question. The shared master index that we use, bringing that same issue of a booklet of application process, is there any way we can streamline that, people don't have to do multiple applications if we can get one data and use the SMI to connect them to different programs?
Madam Chair, that's one possible way to get there, yeah. I mean, the SMI is a great tool that we've built that we know how it works. There are other ways to do that, but that issue you're talking about is one of those key issues when you're dealing with a lot of data across systems like we are, making sure that you're dealing with the right Chuck Johnson, for example. There's a lot of us around when you're looking across those multiple pieces of the database that is a real key to doing this integrated work across different services.
Thank you, Representative Muir. I think you're already a little too deep in the weeds for me to really follow you there. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this recommendation, I see that you would receive matching federal dollars. So for every $10 spent in state funds, you'd be getting an additional $27 to $35 in federal match. So in this $20 million ask for technology, you'd be really having – it's really $80 million of taxpayer funds you'd be using to basically develop your future for technology – including, this long-term roadmap and identifying and defining baseline technology needs. So there's really nothing specific that you're doing other than you're kind of coming up with a plan to address technology for DHS. But, as I talk to people on the spending we have for all these other technology initiatives like MNLARS and MNsure, it seems like we get so deep into spending going down one path, and then, $80 million spent, figuring out what our technology needs are. We've started programs, and then we need more money to, complete a program. It seems like there should be more specific initiatives laid out in, RFPs that have come in and ideas, specific needs before the ask is there for money. That's all. $80 million to address technology is a lot. And this is my day job, what I do in major technology initiatives for, large companies. But we have all the requirements specifically laid out of what we're doing and how we're going to get it done. Is that something that's going to be in your proposal, or is it really just asking for the funding to develop the strategy?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative, we can bring more detail as to what we'll be working on over the next couple of years to give you a better idea. You're right, that's about right on the math as to how the we're able to leverage the federal dollars. As I said, some of that will be in IT improvement, some of it will be in the business work putting together the roadmap, but some of it will be actual IT development, whether it's related to METS or other critical systems where we have some critical needs we need to keep working on and can't just sort of take some time off until we figure out where we're going. Because we right now have over a million Minnesotans we're serving. We're paying out $1 billion in claims through our claim system every day. We have a million people we're doing eligibility on across two different systems. So there's ongoing work that needs to be supported here as well.
Right. Thank you. And Mr. Johnson, I just wanted to make a comment on this, too. And I don't know if $10 million a year is the right number, and we'll certainly look closely at this, but I am kind of heartened by the approach because, you know, what we I sit on the Legislative Audit Commission, and we heard the report from them on MNLARS and kind of some of their suggestions. And one of the things that stuck with me is that we started out without having a really clear idea of where we wanted to end up. And things that need to be simplified, you need to simplify them before you start building the technology, not afterwards. And so we all know that our METS system still has challenges, and we know that we have our systems at the counties that have to interact with that and that those are really old. And we know this is coming, and we cannot avoid moving forward at some point with some more upgrades, and this stuff is extremely expensive. So I think that it is a wise thing to start out putting some money in at the beginning to really figure it out. And I understand what you're saying here. This is not all planning money. It's partly keep fixing what we got and make sure that it stays working, maybe make some improvements in the interim, but also take some time to and some funds to step back and say, where are we going to go? Because if we don't, we have to go somewhere, and we can't continue the way we're going. That is just not an option. Things change, and we need to upgrade these systems. So I think it's very wise for all of us to really try to invest in some planning so that when we do start to really invest big dollars into this, and I know $80 million sounds like a lot of money to ordinary people, and it is. It's a lot of money, but in the scheme of things, you know, the scale of these systems is really enormous, and so we absolutely want to make sure that we do it right before we start building something new. Representative Grinhagen and then Munson.
Chair Liebling's comments brought something to mind for me, and you know, when we talked about MNSURE and the technology, one of the things that came up in the discussion, I don't believe it was with you, but with a MNSURE director, I think, was that the RFPs that were put out did not require or contract the providers that if they put the technology in and it didn't work, they had to come back and fix it, then we were paying them a second time. I mean, you can check back on the testimony. So I don't think anybody in the private sector would do that. So, and one of the responses I got when I asked that question, why are we paying them to come back and fix something when they didn't put it in the right time? The response was, well, it wasn't in the RFP, so we have to pay them again. So I hope when we do these technology RFPs that we will put something in the contract that says if you don't do it right the first time, we're not paying you a second time. Now, I have a friend who does large computer programs for banks. He's retired now, but he's worked with the state in the past, and he says that the RFPs he's looked at in the past, and again, he's been retired for a few years, were very poor wording contractually with providers. So I just encourage you to make sure that when we put these out, that we're not continuing paying these providers if they don't do the job right in the first place. That's just a comment.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Grinhagen. And Representative Munson, and then we're going to let you finish because we need to finish in the next 15 minutes. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on to Representative Grinhagen's lecture. I guess what I would like to add to that, and this kind of goes back to the MNLARS thing too, where you know there's 49 other states out there that print driver's licenses, and we should have been looking to other states to see the software that they use to say, hey, can we give you $10 million and buy that code and put it in here? And when I brought up this common sense solution to many people, and they said, well, you don't understand, Minnesota's laws are so complicated on how we value cars and whatever. And it said, guess what? I can write laws. So we can change the laws to make things more simple to implement this software if other states are doing it better, because 49 other states have sick people too. So they have programs that would be similar. So I would hope that we would look to other states and not only look at building a system that works, but changing our regulations in Minnesota to make it simpler to a pairing of that technology. So that would be my ask.
All right. Thank you. Let's continue with the presentation, and we'll try to hold questions and zoom through, and hopefully we'll have some time at the end for some more questions.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The next several slides are a package around program integrity related to the budget request. There are additional program integrity items that will be in our policy bills as well to address integrity within our programs. The first proposal that is on slide 57 and page 152 of your book is related to non-emergency medical transportation, enhancing program integrity on that program. This is actually the basically the same proposal that we brought forward last year around NEMT. I think this is another area, like we were talking about the adult day centers earlier, where we want to try to get ahead of the curve, or at least not fall too far behind the curve. It's another area where the Inspector General, U.S. Inspector General, did a study of our NEMT and found that 75% of the claims they looked at had something that wasn't right, insufficient documentation, there wasn't a medical appointment associated with the drive that was charged for, no documentation at all in such matters as that. What this would allow us to do is to hire a vendor to do audits at NEMT for us, to give us an ongoing audit function around this so we can identify where there are problems and address those going forward. Would also allow us to enroll the drivers to essentially separate the provider organization from the driver, because sometimes the issue is with the organization, sometimes the issue is with the driver, and it's important to have both of them enrolled so that we can sort of track that. So it's four FTs that would allow us to do the enrollment of the drivers within the non-emergency medical transportation program, as well as doing the spot audits. And it does actually reduce state spending over time, resulting in $2.2 million in savings in 2022 and 2023. The next address is adding more investigators to our SIRS area. SIRS is Surveillance and Integrity Review Section. This oversees medical assistance providers. This is the area that does essentially the fraud and program integrity work around the provider side of our Medicaid program. As you know, Medicaid is the largest program in Minnesota, over $12 billion a year in the program between state and federal money. It's really important that we have good oversight of where those dollars are going related to the payments. What this would do is add four FTEs to this area. This does, again, save money. These FTEs work to save and bring money back to the state in terms of recovered overpayments, and so there's an offset there. This proposal also includes a case management systems for our child care fraud area. We don't currently have a system to manage our cases within the child care fraud work. We have a lot of activity, as folks are aware, within that area. We would like to have a system that allows us to keep that work organized and provide the tracking that we need around our investigations within the child care fraud area. So that is on page 154 in your budget book, addresses those two issues. The next proposal is related to the fraud prevention investigations expansion. That's on page 156 in your budget book. This is a function that's existed for quite a while. It's essentially state funding for counties to hire fraud investigators. Counties do this either individually or sometimes as regions or with partner counties within their area. There's about $3.2 million right now in this grant program. This would add another $700,000 or so through state and federal dollars to bring it up to about $3.9 million. Would add seven investigators across the state. These investigators investigate eligibility or recipient fraud. That's really the focus of what goes on within this program. So that's really individuals who may be inappropriately receiving benefits such as SNAP or TANF, as well as health care programs. The not all counties right now have money under the fraud and prevention investigation. We want to expand to those counties. Some counties also have like one person that goes like across four or five counties, and it can be very thinly staffed in some areas. And so adding the seven FTs would help to address some of those issues. This is a net cost to the state of about $1 million a year. The next proposal addresses electronic visit verification. This is a topic that, again, is familiar to individuals around here who have been involved in Health and Human Services. This is a requirement from the 21st Century Cures Act, a federal law from a couple of years ago, that states create electronic visit verification around personal care assistance services as well as home health services. And what electronic verification does is kind of what it sounds like. It's a way to electronically verify that the service was actually delivered at the location. It's a service that's delivered in people's homes across the state. It can be very hard to verify whether or not that service was actually delivered, actually happened. The EVV essentially allows you to do that electronically through a registration program. And the way we're proposing to handle this here, and this has been with a lot of work with providers and other stakeholders around how to do this, is what we call a hybrid model, which means the state would have available an EVV system that providers could use. But if providers wanted to have their own system, they could have their own system as long as it met the state standards. So most smaller providers are probably going to want to use the state system. Some larger might want to have their own for any variety of reasons. The state system would be a vendor contract. We would not actually build something and operate it ourselves. It would be through a vendor. And so that would be the broad outline of how we do this. There are about 68,000 people that are served through these services. And these, again, are mostly vulnerable people. Most of the services are happening in people's homes. So it's important to understand, that to be able to track and ensure that our dollars are going where they are intended to go. This would require PCAs under federal law, require PCAs to start using EVV in 2020, so a short timeline for PCAs, home health in 2023. This is an investment in 2021, about $900,000, but actually results in savings over the long term, $7.3 million in savings in the 2022-23 biennium.
So, Madam Chair, I will just try to fly through these last seven slides in 5 minutes. Luckily, these are all compliance. These are mainly compliance proposals as well as a few technical adjustments. So we'll move through them fairly quickly here. The first is to bring the state into compliance with the 2016 Federal Medicaid Outpatient Drug Rule. This would modify our fee-for-service reimbursement for our outpatient prescription drugs. It is required that we pay for the acquisition cost as well as for a professional dispensing fee. We are currently one of four states who are out of compliance, and we are at risk of losing $190 million a year. So we'll just leave that one there.
Yeah. I would just like to comment for members that on Thursday we're going to be hearing the bill on this issue.
Great. The next is on page 168 through 169. This is updating our durable medical equipment payment methodology. This is a proposal that allows us to comply with federal law that limits the rates for DME, or durable medical technology, for which federal matching funds are available to the Medicare rate. This will prevent, administrative burden and financial insecurity from having to recover those overpayments. And finally, it really simplifies the reimbursement formulas for products that don't have a Medicare rate to ensure that the state pays a fair and predictable rate. So this produces a savings of $8.2 million in 2021 and then $1.3 million. And this next is, and I'm sorry because this section of the presentation does kind of jump around your change pages a little bit. So that goes from 168 to 169, and then we're going to jump to pages 191 through 199. But these are truly some clarifying and technical proposals. So I'll just say quickly that the first is the early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention criminal background study. So this is EIDBI. It's our service that's provided for autism and autism-related diseases to youth, and this requires that those providers participate in the state's NET studies background checks. The second is really providing some updates to our HIV statutes, and this is really to improve health care coverage for these individuals as well as assuring that they are having access to their premium assistance and providing coverage for out-of-pocket drugs. Really just critical that we're allowing individuals to manage their viral suppression, and this allows us to promote access to both insurance and coverage for out-of-pocket drug cost. The next is just a very slight restructuring of our semi-independent living services grant. This is a really excellent grant program that allows individuals to access, you know, services to allow them to be independent in their communities. There is currently a 30% local share on that, or local participation. We feel like that's restricting access across some of the state to these funds. So we're just reducing that to 15%. And that is budget neutral because we believe the underspending currently from the 30% will result in just the same amount of spending. There's also a proposal to create a separate skilled nursing visit code. So currently for a healthcare home visit, there is just one code that is billed regardless of whether the service is provided by a registered nurse or a licensed nurse practitioner. This will create two separate codes for that, so one for the RN and one for the LPN. That results in a bit of a savings because some of those services which are currently provided by LPNs will be charged at a little bit lower rate. And then finally, a very, very little proposal that we think will impact maybe three people, but it's important that we make sure that everybody who is eligible for PCA services is also eligible for a future CFSS service. And so this just allows us to authorize state and funding for a small category of people who are eligible. We have two proposals, and these actually, these are on pages 179 through 190 of your change page, and these actually aren't technical. These are actually investments in our Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division. So I did want them to have their own little platform because these are important services, and as Minnesota ages, our hard of hearing population is also greatly increasing. So one of these proposals is just the modernization of the telephone equipment distribution program. This is a program that really allows people to access adaptive technology, which, you know, initially was the telephone and now has evolved. So this is modernizing that program so that people can access different services. There's no impact on the general fund. The TED program is funded through the telephone Access Minnesota special revenue account, and that's a surcharge on telephone equipment, and there's no expected increase in those surcharges. The other is a very moderate investment of $211,000 ongoing in our grants to increase sign language interpreter capacity across Minnesota. And this is a really cool grant program. I mean, they do things like increase capacity for K-12 educators because those are very specific interpreter services. It's assuring that there's interpreters for AA meetings, which is really important because that's not covered under the ADA. And then there's a program that allows for deaf interpreters to be with an ASL interpreter so that they can really pick up on the nuances of the conversation, and that's been a program that's been in great demand. So those are modern investments for some really nice access to services in Greater Minnesota in particular. This next set of proposals, again, this kind of jumps around in your book a bit, but these are technical and compliance changes around our healthcare program. So the first is to bring our medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, or MAEPD, into conformity with a state plan that has been submitted. So we just need to get statute in alliance with our state plan. There's a proposal just modifying the payment formula for Indian Health Center services, serving people who are enrolled in both medical assistance and Medicare to be consistent with how similarly situated providers are reimbursed. There is a proposal in here to improve our medical assistance benefit recovery. This really will improve our ability to ensure that medical assistance serves as the payer of last resort through implementation of an electronic case management system, and that will improve data sharing between DHS and the Department of Public Safety. We have a proposal clarifying and strengthening provider screening and enrollment, which is really important as we enroll and validate and assure that our providers are meeting all of the medical assistance requirements. And then finally, a proposal that is aligning our application assistance payments. So currently, and this is for people who are known as navigators, so helping people enroll in programs. And this is just assuring that we are incenting people to help people successfully enroll in medical assistance. So that is aligning some of those assistance payments.
Mr. Johnson, and we have like 2 minutes.
Yeah. No problem, Madam Chair. So this is some proposals related to better government, mostly some very small budget items, pages 172 to 176 and 210 to 218 in your book. The first is child care federal compliance and fees for certified exempt centers. They're child care centers, mostly school-aged. A couple of years ago, we brought this proposal in. We were asked to come back with a fee proposal to support this ongoing work. This provides that fee proposal. This is a federal requirement under the reauthorization the feds did to the child care block grant a couple of years ago. Similarly, number two is a background study, federal compliance. This is also related to the reauthorization of the child care program. This would allow us to add three additional databases to our background studies that we aren't getting to now. We need to under federal law by adding a couple of FTEs to help support that work going forward. On page 175 is the False Claims Act compliance. This is to align Minnesota with the False Claims Act. That allows us to be able to retain additional federal money as an incentive when we make collections back on programs that are also funded by the federal government. Prohibition on mutation of child support. Imputation of income for incarcerated child support programs. This relates to a very small number of people who might be incarcerated under the owe child support and how we can impute child support when they're in prison. It's a federal requirement. It's a small change that requires some system modification. And then finally, homeless management information system. This would propose that DHS invest about $680,000 a year in helping to support with the Housing Finance Agency, a system that a lot of the providers of homeless services across the state use to track individuals who are homeless, the reasons they're homeless, the length of time, all sorts of information that helps us to improve services for homeless individuals is also helpful in terms of federal compliance with HUD, as they require a lot of data in order to maintain about $40 million a year in HUD payments around housing.
All right, so we are a little bit over, members. We just had one question. Representative Munson, do you have just a quick question that we could, before we adjourn here?
Yeah, so on page 154 of the book here on CCAP, the CCAP investigation expansion, I see that you are going to hire four additional, propose to hire four additional investigators to investigate fraud, and that those four people would bring in approximately $500,000 in fraudulent claims, so reducing the amount of money that's paid. So you're expecting each person to get $125,000 in fraud taken care of each year. But it says that they receive a federal financial participation allocation. So does that mean the federal government gives individuals a share of the savings if they find and stop fraud for federal dollars? And can you speak to how much that is?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Munson, I'm not sure what the share is relative to. So the investigators we're hiring are actually to investigate medical assistance provider fraud. The CCAP piece of this page is related to the case management system to help us track our CCAP fraud investigations. Those are kind of two things that are in the page here. I'm not sure which allocation you're referring to, but I can get back on that. There are programs, and I don't know how it works exactly in Medicaid, but when the state pursues an overpayment, we get to keep some of the federal share as an incentive by the federal government to allow us to encourage us to pursue those overpayments.
And is that money paid to the individual or to the program?
Madam Chair, it's paid to the state, not to the individual.
Members, we are over time here, so I'm afraid we're not going to get to the next two questions, but I'm sure that the presenters will be happy to take those offline. And so we will be back tomorrow, and our agenda for tomorrow, we have some bills. We're going to be talking about tobacco and related subjects. So with that, we are adjourned.